Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to House Committee on Rules. I almost said revenue. I'm looking over there at you, Representative Berger, for some reason. And today is May 2nd, 2011. We're going to go through, just share really quick what we're going to do today. We're going to start out with a work session on House Bill 3145. And then we're going to move to House Bill 2257. And then we'll return back to possible a public hearing on House Bill 3614, since Representative Widener's here. And then we'll move to House Bill 3621, and then finish out the public hearings on House Bill 3635, and then we'll do the memorial resolutions after that. So let's open up a work session on House Bill 3145A.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3145. This came to the committee last week, and it is regarding the Oregon Bottle Bill. Let me go into a little bit of detail on it. It expands Oregon's Bottle Bill deposit law to cover any liquid intended for human consumption in quantity less than or equal to 1.5 liters beginning January 1st, 2018, or 1 year after the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, OLCC, determines that at least 60% of beverage containers returned for refund are returned to approved redemption center, whichever comes first. It has some exclusions in it: cough, syrup, liquor, wine, dairy products. It also increases the deposit of the refund value of beverage containers to not less than 10 cents beginning January 1st of a calendar year following the determination by OLCC that in each of the two previous calendar years, less than 80% of beverage containers sold in the state were returned for refund. It authorizes the OLC to approve one beverage container redemption center pilot project in a city other than Portland. It requires the pilot project redemption center to accept and pay refund value on up to 300 individual empty beverage containers per person per day. It establishes convenience zones centered around the pilot project redemption center and identifies which dealers, based on the square footage and distance from the redemption center, may participate in the pilot project. It allows participating dealers within 1.5 miles of the pilot project redemption center to refuse to accept return containers. It imposes obligations on dealers larger than 5,000 square feet located in convenience zones and not participating in the pilot project. That's the dash A version of the measure. You have the dash A6 amendment. It does a few minor things. It clarifies the application of the measure limited to beverages rather than liquids, as I just described. It authorizes the OLCC to define further exceptions by administrative rule. It adds additional months prior to a change to a 10-cent deposit following the OLCC's 80% determination, and it requires OLCC approval of Redemption Center for a pilot project. Mr. Chairman, we have a no revenue statement on the dash A6. We are waiting for the fiscal. The dash A version had a minimal fiscal impact. The amendment makes minor changes to the dash A.
Okay. Representative Cannon, Representative Berger, welcome. Kind of catch us up to speed where we're at with these.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46. Jim has done a good job of explaining both the underlying bill, the A engrossed version of the bill, as well as the amendments that are proposed in the dash A6s. This bottle bill update will do three significant things. One, it will no later than January 1st, 2018, update the product list that's covered to include additional containers. We can talk more about what we're getting at when we look more carefully at the dash sixes. Number two, it will potentially increase the deposit on those containers from 5 cents to 10 cents, but only if redemption rates for the bottle bill fall below 80%. And number three, it will establish a one-time pilot of a larger redemption center than the distributor cooperative has operated to date, and that pilot is described in the final section of the bill. So you have dash six amendments in front of you. We can go over what specifically those change. There was a lot of discussion after the A engrossed version came out of the Energy, Environment, and Water Committee. On a 7-1 vote, I should note, there was quite a bit of discussion about the definition of beverage. And we can look more carefully at the way we've approached that in dash sixes. I want to express my appreciation for a colleague at my side, Representative Berger, whose commitment to this issue, long before I ever came to the bottle bill, had a great deal to do with the fact that we're here today. That includes the very significant changes that were made with her leadership in 2007 when we added water bottles and began this update.
Thank you, respected co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Berger. A lot of the discussion that has revolved around this current bottle bill proposal has been about containers within the bottle bill. The original bottle bill was simplicity itself. It didn't talk about containers. It talked about carbonated beverages within the containers, which made life very simple for those in 1971, because if it was a carbonated beverage, it was in, and if it was not, it was not. However, the number and types of containers has exponentially exploded, and at this point, the target containers are basically those original aluminum containers and glass containers of the original bottle bill. Believe me, plastic water bottles were not envisioned in 1971 in Oregon as being a consumer product. So in the 07 session, we added those water bottles. And in doing so, we were pretty specific about the type of container. But I think left on the table are a host of containers that come in those, or a host of beverages that come in those targeted containers. Tea in a pop can. Sports drink in a water bottle that are the target, really, of this particular legislation. It is nobody's intention to add ketchup to the bottle bill or those kinds of containers. But getting to that language is difficult because you just can't say what's in it. You have to get to something that talks about the containers and the beverage, the idea of beverage. So this is centered around the idea of beverages, not ketchup, and it is basically trying to get at the sports drinks and the kinds of teas that are in cans that look just like a pop can and those kinds of containers. And as such, I think we can get there because I think the understanding, and that's one of the reasons that I'm talking about it right now, is to put it on the legislative record that is our target, not infant formula, not milk products, which have always been out of the bottle bill, not any kind of drug or anything of that nature. It is specifically those kinds of sports drinks that and those kinds of teas and juices that come in containers that are exactly like the water and pop containers that are currently covered. And so that is our target on this, and it is not an immediate thing, and plenty of room is given within this statutory language for the date off into the future when these things would become recyclable under the bottle bill that would give the industries plenty of time to prepare for that. So we're not trying to surprise anybody or suddenly do something. We're trying to give fair warning that these are containers that should be in our bottle bill and eventually will be.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may add to that, since we're speaking to the record, I think it is really important for both of us to express our very strong intent that the beverages that would be included under this expansion are beverages. Okay, we intend to include beverages. So I think Representative Berger put it well, not pharmaceutical products, not condiments, not maple syrups, soda syrups, not ketchups and cocktail sauce, not salad dressings, not olive oils and cooking oils, soy sauces, vinegars, other liquids. And I think that's where the original, the engrossed version, confused some folks. Here, and specifically in Section 2, Sub 2, Sub B, we get at the additional products, and it, The language is any beverage other than those that are currently in. That's specified in paragraph A, intended for human consumption, and there are some other conditions, including can't be smaller than 4 fluid ounces, can't be larger than a liter and a half. It's not liquor, wine, dairy, or plant-based milks, infant formula, or other exemptions set forth in rule. But again, to underscore the point that Representative Berger made, we are talking about what I think commonly folks would understand to be beverages, teas, juices, sports drinks, energy drinks, and the like.
Any questions? Representative Winger?
Mr. Chair. Representatives, I appreciate your hard work on this bill. I know that there are a lot of moving parts and that it's a very difficult and long negotiation to get everybody to what they can live with, I guess would be the best way to categorize it. I have a question around water, though. I had a concern raised that seems to make sense to me, that if the deposit goes to 10 cents because water is such a low-cost item, that this has a really significant impact on the cost at the grocery store or point of sale for, say, a big box full of bottled water. Was there any discussion at all, or is there any willingness, because this bill has other steps to go, to perhaps carve out from the 10-cent adjustment those products that have a price point that's so low, like water, keeping them at 5 cents and not going to 10, I guess is the point I'm making, so that it doesn't have such a disproportionate impact on the price of the product at the point of sale?
Representative, it's a fair point. However, I think you need to understand that the reason that water was added was because I think most people who purchase a beverage-sized bottle of water understand full well that it's not the water they're purchasing, it's the container. It is the convenience of the container. And therefore, when we added water to the bottle bill, it was because of the understanding that these containers become an issue in and of themselves when they're not recycled. I don't anticipate that we're going to get to the recycling triggers within here that we get to a dime. But if we do, I think it's important that we understand that we really want these bottles back, these containers back, and that's the purpose of this redemption system, is to return what you've purchased, which is basically a bottle. The water, you know, comes out of the tap pretty well, and most bottled water is essentially tap water, except that which comes from Fiji, I'm sure, or maybe, you know, Iceland or some other exotic place. However, it is the container that they are purchasing, and the redemption is the encouragement we need to have them bring that container back.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Is it intended to cover Gatorades, iced teas immediately or not till 2018?
No.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, the mechanism for the expanded product is the sooner of two events. Either the redemption center system, which to date includes just two locations, one in Wood Village, one in Oregon City, either the redemption center system handles 60% of the returns in this state, or January 1st, 2018 rolls around. Whichever of those two happens sooner is the date on which the added containers will be included.
There's no expansion prior to that.
There is no expansion prior to one of those two events.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you very much, and I do greatly appreciate that. And I would have some concern if somebody thought Heinz 57 was a beverage.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
We agree with you.
However,
it is
a
beverage.
Thank you very much.
He said it was a beverage. You were totally right for that, weren't you?
Just a vegetable, not a beverage.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Winger.
So I would move the dash A9 amendments to House Bill 3145.
Representative Wingard moves the dash nines into House Bill 3145A. Is there objections?
Oh, yes.
That's not what we just heard about, is it?
I was
going to discuss this. I think there will be an objection.
Okay, well, okay. Why don't you go ahead and discuss it then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, if you called on me, but I'm going to start talking. So the Dash 9s are, and I had multiple eyes verify this, they are exactly what the A6s do, except that the 10-cent trigger has been pulled out of the bill. This is the place that I'm hung up on the bill. Otherwise, I think that it's great to see that people have come together on finding a way to advance the bottle bill, and I would like to be able to support the bill, but I see this as a pretty significant increase on folks, and I'm not convinced that the trigger won't eventually be met, and not least of which, what I think happens to low price point products like water bottles, I think it has a significant effect, but we can debate whether or not it's a fee increase or not, but many people believe that it is, and I'd like to remove that piece so that I can support the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that I believe members have the Dash 9, the A9. If anyone doesn't, I have an extra copy of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually really applaud the sponsors of this. The way they've put together the 10 cents, I actually think is kind of the perfect free market alternative where it only goes to 10 cents. I mean, if we get the policy goal of having greater than 80% returns, it stays at 5% or 5 cents forever, which is, I think, a very artful, I would not have thought of that kind of thoughtful alternative of be focused on the policy objective, and if we get there through 5 cents, I think that's everybody's ideal goal, and I think we'll all be motivated to get to that 80% and stick with the 5 cents. So I actually would encourage us to not approve this amendment and stick with the A6s as they are.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move to substitute the A6 for the A9s.
Okay. Representative Barnhart moves the Dash 6 into House Bill 3145. Due discussion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this puts squarely before the committee the issue of the 10 cents, because if this motion is adopted, then it substitutes for the main amendment, which is the A9s. If it's not adopted, then we're back on the A9s. My understanding from the testimony that we heard was that this was the amendment that had been sort of worked through, and that I frankly, we've got two other amendments, maybe three other amendments, A7 and A10. I don't even know what those are because I just got them a few minutes ago. But I think this squarely places before the committee the choice between the 10-cent issue, if this one's substituted for the A9, or if it isn't, then of course it takes that away.
Okay, thank you.
And I support the motion I made.
Okay, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Olson. The A9s, in my reading and understanding, are exactly the same as the A6 without the 10-cent increase, even triggering in the future. Some might describe the current mechanism for triggering be market-based. I would contend that anytime government requires something to happen, it's hard for me to understand how that's market-based. But that being said, I don't see the need for the 10 cent to be included at this time, and there'll be legislative sessions between now and when that trigger would occur anyway. So that would be my preference to adopt the A9s.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe my motion was premature, and I'd like to be given permission to withdraw it.
Thank you.
Okay. We vote on the A9s, right?
So is there an objection getting back to the Dash 9s?
Yes.
Okay, we've got 3.
Yes.
4.
Oh. Bill, please call the roll.
Can we call for the question?
Call the roll.
We did call the roll.
And what are we voting on?
This is the Dash 9s into House Bill 3145.
So the motion is to adopt the Dash 9s.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby?
No.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Berger?
No.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
No.
Co-Chair Hunt?
No.
Co-Chair Olson?
No. So the dash nines being considered to be adopted in House Bill 3145
no. Reject.
Fails is rejected.
Just give me a little. Just.
No.
Even when I lose, I win.
We got there. This is just Monday, okay? Just relax, okay?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 3145.
Representative Berger would like to move the dash 6 amendments into House Bill 3145. Is there further discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, this is the motion that this is the version of this legislation that Representative Cannon and I were speaking to. It includes the elements that we discussed. And I think it is the best we can do today with this bill.
Okay. Further, Representative Freeman.
I wanted to thank the work that's been done on this bill and the chance to do some amendments before it comes to the House floor. Again, my preference would have been to have the 10 cents out of it and work on that later. That being said, the rest of the work I'm very comfortable with and will be voting for the motion today.
Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm disappointed that I was not able to pull the 10-cent piece out of the bill. I do support the rest of the bill, but I cannot support the bill because of the 10-cent fee increase, and therefore I will be a no on the bill. But I appreciate the work of all the parties involved.
Okay. Any other further? Representative. Okay, so the dash
we're going to have a roll call vote?
So dash A6 amendments are being moved into House Bill 3145.
Can you ask for objections?
Any? Okay.
I'm not going to object.
Roll call, please.
Representative Winger.
We're going to call a roll. No.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye. Dash A6 are moved into House Bill 3145A.
Mr. Chair, we are awaiting the fiscal impact statement, but I think we've been informed that it's not going to change it from what it was when it came out of the Energy, Environment, and Water Committee, so I would move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of considering House Bill 3145A as amended without the fiscal impact statement.
Mr. Co-Chairs, can we do that?
If we pass this motion, yes.
We're going to suspend the rules for the fiscal to be able to move it to the House floor.
Where are the Rules Committee?
Yes.
Okay.
Chair Hunt has moved the suspension of the rules for the purpose of considering House Bill 3145A without fiscal report statement. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Now, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3145 as amended with the A6 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3145A with A6 amendments to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
No.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. House Bill 3145 is amended, has passed, and Representative Berger and I imagine Representative Cannon will be carrying? Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2257. Jim.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2257, you've seen a number of times. It requires portraits and documents for the voters' pamphlet filed with the Secretary of State to be by candidates and political parties to be filed electronically. You have the Dash 4 amendment, which makes electronic filing discretionary. It allows four extra calendar days for electronic filing to Monday, the 64th day prior to the primary. It allows public inspection beginning the fourth business day following the filing deadlines. It directs Secretary of State to adopt electronic filing system, and it adds an emergency clause effective upon passage. You may recall that we were awaiting the fiscal just during our meeting a week ago. The Dash 4 fiscal arrived. The fiscal statement has been distributed, and we have a no fiscal impact statement or no revenue impact statement on the Dash 4. So the Dash 4 has the paperwork needed.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2257.
Chair Hunt moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2257. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2257 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves House Bill 2257 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
I'm sorry.
Representative
Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart? Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
House Bill 2257 passes, and who would like to carry it? Okay. I'll carry it. Okay. Close work session on House Bill 2257 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3614.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3614 prohibits the city or district from requiring landowner to consent to eventual annexation in exchange for continuing extraterrestrial service originally provided to landowner or predecessor in interest of landowner without requiring consent to annexation. It voids consent to eventual annexation if consent was obtained in
extraterrestrial.
Same difference.
Whoever wrote this. Okay. Sounds like it declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage.
Thank you very kindly. Okay. Let's see. Representative Widener and Representative Cowan, did
she's going to?
Are you?
She's going to the same time?
She's going to speak in opposition.
Oh, okay, disregard. And let's see, Jack Orchard, if you thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson.
I wrote this.
Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, I am State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, most of Yamhill County, some of Polk County. Colleagues, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3614 today. I sponsored this bill because I have constituents affected by Lincoln City's coercive annexation tactics. I'd like to start by saying there are a few basic services that humans need to function. One is food, which this bill does not address, but I have addressed in other bills this session already. Other services that are essential to human life are water, sanitary, sewer, and power. That's what this bill addresses. Those three services, which are vitally important, what the bill does is stop cities and special districts from requiring a landowner to consent to annex in exchange for water, sewer, or power if they did not tell them up front at the time when they provided the service that annexation would be required. Simply put, this bill stops cities and special districts from changing the rules midstream. A little background on the situation is as follows. In 1978, the City of Lincoln City entered into a 25-year agreement with Rhodes End residents to provide them with water services. The city has about 6,200 water accounts, and of those accounts, just over 1,200 accounts are located outside the city's urban growth boundary. Half of those are at Rhodes Inn, are Rhodes Inn's residents. Rhodes Inn residents pay 212% more than city residents for water service. That agreement has expired, and the city has, through a series of resolutions and ordinances, initiated the process of requiring consent to annex forms in order to, for Rhodes Inn residents to continue to receive water. House Bill 3614 does not remove the ability of Lincoln City or any other local government to plan and eventually annex the Rhodes Inn area. This bill simply says that local government cannot first provide service like water to an area and then later require annexation, an annexation agreement. As a condition to continue to receive water, the city, instead of holding a vote, has chosen to use coercion as a tool for gaining annexation. I believe we have an obligation at the minimum to reject the city's arguments against the bill until they have had an election and explain the advantages of living in the city. Many of the cities in our districts have provisions that require annexation to be voter approved, e.g. Salem, Monmouth, Albany, Lake Oswego, Sherwood, McMinnville, and I believe Yamhill as well. What's so wrong with offering the Rhodes Inn residents the same opportunity to vote as awarded to their communities? Finally, in closing, I'd just like to reference something that Lincoln City Mayor Dick Anderson in his 2011 State of the City speech said. He ended with a quote from Abraham Lincoln. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. I couldn't agree more, and I am pleased that Mayor Anderson agrees that the public sentiment is important. I encourage the committee to pass House Bill 3614, since the city has chosen not to hold a public vote on annexation and instead has chosen to threaten loss of an essential human service required to sustain life, and that is water.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Jack Orchard. I'm an attorney in Portland with the law firm of Baljanic. The Rhodes Inn Group asked that I share with you some perspectives on annexation. In light of my role in litigating, I think, the last major annexation case that went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court. That was a case that arose out of the island annexation, forceful annexation policies of the city of Beaverton. It resulted in legislation by this body in 2007. The Supreme Court case sparked some very spirited discussion back and forth among the justices about what the rules are and what the policies are for annexation in this state. The case, I would have liked to have seen a unanimous result, but I didn't. Five of the justices went the way that my client and I urged. Two of the justices did not. But I think if you look at the opinion, the Costco wholesale case versus City of Beaverton, you'll see that it's a very robust discussion with the policy issues laid out quite nicely. The majority opinion, the five justices who believed that what Beaverton had done was improper under Oregon's annexation system, said the following things, and I've covered this in the summary that has been distributed to you, but I'd just like to go over the highlights. First of all, there is no inherent authority, either home rule or by virtue of a municipality existing, that allows that municipality to simply annex. It's all a creature of statute in this state. Interestingly, Justice Walters, who wrote the opinion, said, and she quoted an earlier case, in fact, a much earlier case, that used the language that it's repugnant to fairness and justice that an enterprising city could force those outside the city to come into their city. And I think that's the crux of the way the court decided the matter. The court went on to say that in our system, with two exceptions, there are no forceful annexations and there are no coercive annexations. The only two exceptions are an island annexation, which this body has significantly limited as a result of the Beaverton case, and where you have a legitimate health hazard, sanitation hazard, water quality hazard. Other than those two examples, there is no forced annexation in the state. It either must be done by consent or by election. The process is controlled exclusively by the legislature. And in the case, Justice Walters pointed out that there is this trade-off that goes on. You can give the cities greater rights, and you take it away from the individuals. And the way the court came down was to stress the value of choice, because annexation is not a decision about provision of services. It's not who gets water or sewer or police protection from which agency and whether that's the right agency or not. It recognizes that there's an entire spectrum of relationship between property owners and municipalities that's bound up in the annexation discussion. So, in our state, the way we approach these things is not through coercion, not through confrontation. It's by a process in which property owners believe that annexation is an appropriate way to view themselves and their relationship with government. And I think when faced with the issue, the Supreme Court came squarely down on the side of saying it is a matter of choice. Choice at the citizen level is extremely important because there are many values that are caught up in the annexation discussion. So with respect to the direction that the House bill goes, it is consistent with the way the Supreme Court has handled the case. It is consistent with the attitudes that were put squarely in front of the court in 2007 about whether cities should have greater authority to bring properties and citizens into a city. And I think as a result, the bill is entirely consistent with really 100 years of statutory and case law in this state regarding annexations. Thank you very much.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and I wanted to thank the representative for bringing this bill forward and for the attorney to take some time to testify. I have a couple questions, and I've been through this annexation stuff way too many times serving on a local city council. Under the current statute, is there any regulations or laws that require cities to provide services outside of their city limits?
I don't know. Well, that's an interesting question. Is there a law that does that? This is where you get into this combination or confluence of what annexation is about. It's a planning concept. It's a citizen concept. It's a legislative political concept. You may have comprehensive plans that are adopted on a countywide basis that, in fact, designate where the most efficient service provision comes from. The area where I live in Washington County, of course, is an area that is populated by special service districts. In fact, one of the issues in the Beaverton case was what services did Beaverton really provide to the properties that it was attempting to forcibly annex? And when you got down to it, the answer was darn little, because the special service districts had really blanketed the field. So the direct answer to your question is I don't believe there is, although at the comprehensive planning issue and through intergovernmental agreements, there are divisions of both service efficiency and service territory. First, Beaverton's a good example. Water service in Beaverton, depending upon the elevation that your property's at, either comes from Tualatin Valley Water or it comes from the city of Beaverton.
Thank you. And
to follow up on that a little bit, one of the things that I've seen in our district, outside of the city, lots of times, like for police, you'll find that the county sheriff will handle most of that. The city, pretty much they stay in the city and handle issues in the city. You do run into a lot of areas that, where you'll run into counties where they're receiving water from the city, and that's all that they receive, and they're on a city hookup, and they're paying the water rates, but they receive no other services from the city, and the rest that they receive comes from the counties.
Thank you. And I think you're right. I don't think there's anywhere in statute, but I think there's lots in practice around the state that there's a blending of special districts and service provisions for cities outside the limits. The other question I had was that I understand the agreement for a period of time that Representative Widener talked about in his opening statement there. My question is there any sort of obligation to a title company through title insurance or anything that would require that property purchasers would know that they're on a limited agreement for a service delivery? I mean, if there's a 25-year agreement in place for water delivery, it would seem as if that would be an important thing for a property owner to know when he bought his property.
You've got a room full of people from Rhodes End, and that's probably a good question for them. I think the short answer is, you know, it's possible if the title company is extremely astute and well-informed, but it's not the typical kind of things that shows up in a title report.
I can tell you that it happened. The same exact thing happened in my area, and most of the people had no idea they were on a limited duration agreement. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next panel, Terry Castor, Shannon Locke, and Mark Hoyt. Come up together and just give you a heads up because we're going to be pressed for time. We're going to monitor you, but give you each 2 minutes.
I dropped that.
Thanks for attending to that. Appreciate that. If you'd identify you yourself and begin, please.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt. Members of this committee, my name is Terry Castor. I am from Scotts Mills. I've owned a home at Rhodes End since 1999. In August of 2006, my wife and I bought a different house at Rhodes End, one built before 2004, so it was already hooked up to water. We're not rich or well-to-do. This home is financed. It is a financial struggle to keep it, but it's our American dream. Excuse me. If there was an agreement to annex like Lincoln City claims, my wife and I haven't heard about it dating back to 1999. Nobody I know was aware of any agreement. Lincoln City's requirement that I sign consent to annex and the time limit waiver for forms was not disclosed to me. When my wife and I were surprised in escrow to see the form, we refused to sign them. Lincoln City put the water account in my name without signed forms. I thought that was the end of it. I paid my water bill and I paid it on time. My wife and I were in the house for nearly 3 years when Lincoln City sent us a letter demanding that I sign a consent to annex form. There wasn't any change in the water account. One day when I went home in April of 2009, I turned on the water only to discover Lincoln City had shut it off. I went to Lincoln City Hall and spoke with City Manager David Hawker. Obviously, I was very upset. You would be too. Human beings need water. Hawker had just shut mine off. It was really wrong. Hawker's reaction was extremely hard and indifferent in his rudeness. Hawker was very curt and dry. You sign or you won't get water. Hawker had no empathy, no sympathy. It was Hawker's way or the highway. After meeting with Hawker, I felt I was beat up. It was as nasty as it could be. For Hawker and his municipality, it was just a numbers game. I walked out of there knowing that I was coerced, knowing that I was being forced to consent. My ox had been gored, and nobody gave a darn. Government institutions that are supposed to serve me cut my water off. My water bill was paid.
Terry, if you could, sorry, we're limiting everybody for 2 minutes right now. If you could just wrap it up here real quickly.
Pardon me?
If you could wrap it up here real quick for
okay.
us. We're, thank you.
My wife and I drank bottled water for a month. And in the end, we just can't use a house without water. I had no choice. Hawker won. We finally signed the papers. The worst of it is that signing the papers, it attaches to the deed and it becomes, it's in perpetuity. One of the key points of fairness and equity of this proposed legislation is to remove this coerced document from my deed. This bill will return us to the pre-Hawker status quo. With 20/20 vision in hindsight, I wish I would have just walked away, but Lincoln's bullying has been a never-ending nightmare. My background is in real estate. The nightmare won't end with Lincoln City. Based on my experience, I can tell you that the Council of Oregon Governments is waiting for the legislation to do nothing, and the citizens in Oregon will receive this. Other citizens in Oregon will see the same treatment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair. Are there any questions?
Just a moment.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and committee members, my name is Shannon Locke, and I reside in Rhodes Bend and also in Portland. My parents and my brother and his family also use our Rhodes Bend residence. Our beach house is our family inheritance. In the 30s, my great-grandfather had a house in Culver City, or Cutler City, and in the 70s, that was sold and enabled us to acquire a Rhodes Bend cabin about 40 years ago. It really feels like Lincoln City is using a steamroller on us with the threats to turn our water off, and it's extremely stressful. It's fair to say that it's even more stressful on my elderly parents. Our family, we signed under duress. My mother felt compelled to sign. In signing for our water rights, she felt like she was making our service reliable and that it would be secure, but it's a now looks like that's, you know, the furthest thing from the truth. I'm not here to say whether we should annex or not, but I don't think we should be forced to do so. I spent much of my life in Rhodes Bend, and over time there's many more permanent residents there and many older residents who are hoping to live out their lives in their homes. And with this annexation and the proposed 40% tax hike, that's probably not going to be possible. Myself, I would also like to retire there, and we'd like to be able to pass on our house to the fifth generation. At least we'd like to be able to make it possible to sell it sometime in the future, but you know, right now, our house does not have any value as far as I'm concerned because we don't have water rights, and if we had to sell our house today, we wouldn't be able to do so. I've heard some talk from residents that say, well, let's just let Hawker turn the water off, but what I've discovered is from his comment recently in the local paper, he said, if this annexation bill doesn't pass, we'll go ahead and annex Rhodes Bend forcefully anyway. And I couldn't understand how that could be, but in looking at the state law more carefully, I do see that if he does shut our water off, it will be an emergency, and under that, we would be forcefully annexed immediately.
Shannon, if you could just kind of wrap
it
up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hate to see this happen to other communities, and I think if the legislature doesn't do something to stop this, that there's going to be other people before you asking for your protection. I don't think this is the Oregon way to force people, and this should be an example of what not to do in our great state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark?
Thank you. Co-Chairs Olson, Hunt, committee members, thank you for your time today. I am a third-generation property owner in
Rhodes
End.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mark Hoyt. I'm a third-generation property owner in Rhodes End. My son is in the wings waiting to be the fourth-generation property owner. My grandmother bought the house in 1946 because she was forced to live with her mother in Portland and wanted a place that was hers where she could take her kids. It's been in the family ever since, and we will never sell it because if we do, we know she will come back and do awful things. And I'm not here to necessarily oppose annexation. I'm here to oppose the process that the property owners out there are being exposed to. The annexation statutes currently allow and authorize compelled consent when services are extended. In this circumstance, services have already been extended pursuant to an agreement that if you look at the contract by which those services were extended, the city received direct benefit and actually contributed to that cost because they knew they were going to receive that benefit. Now, faced with fiscal crisis, they're looking for any tax dollar they can find. And what's important to look at as you look at this is what is going on, because annexation is tied to two things, ownership and voting. In this context, what they're asking you to do is waive your right to vote. And the people who live in Rhodes End are not residents of the city of Lincoln City, hence the issue. So they can't vote for the very same city council members who are compelling this annexation. So in effect, what they are doing is saying, now that we have created this dependency, you gave up a perfectly functional water system and water district, gave it to us in exchange for service. We did not ask at that time, as we were authorized under the law, for compelled consent, which they could have done. And now we're going to come back and say, we want you to consent. We want that because it's convenient for us because we're going to realize a revenue increase. And in so doing, they are asking people to waive their right to vote. They're taking away that option. And in essence, what that essentially becomes, if you're familiar with it, it's inconsistent with the principles of democracy. They're saying, no, we've created dependency. In order to sustain that dependency, waive your rights. That's not right. It's essentially, if you look at it, not dissimilar from taxation without representation that resulted in the Boston Tea Party. We don't have a harbor at Road's End, but we have a legislature. So we're here tipping some tea into your harbor and saying, please help us. We've been put in this position by others. That position was created because they wanted the benefit of that water system. I see my light is up. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions? Thank you very much. Next panel, Representative Gene Cowan and David Hawker. And Dick Anderson. Okay, good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you know, it's really very disappointing for me to be here in front of you today. And that's because, as you heard, one of our members brought forth, sponsored a bill that directly and solely impacts my district without any conversation with me. So it's difficult to have to challenge it from this direction. There are many, many questions involved here that have not been clearly delineated, and the folks next to me are going to do that. Water is the question. But what's important is that there is no contract in place at this point to provide water to these individuals that you're hearing from today. And that's concerning. This dates back to the contract to provide water that was a 25-year contract and expired in 2003. I'm very familiar with this particular question because it's been going on for years. During the time, my 12-year tenure as a county commissioner, we discussed this, and it's been moving forward very gradually. I am concerned for these individuals that if the annexation doesn't move forward and the service then logically be provided and continued by the city, there is no contract in place for water. And like everyone else that you've heard from, that would be a tragedy for the homeowners in this district. I don't think the sponsor of the bill fully understands the history, but those folks that are here with me can better explain it to you. So I want to turn it over to Mayor David Hawker, City Manager David Hawker, and Mayor Dick Anderson. I'll get the name straight here in just a second. Sorry about that.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs Hunt and Olson. Thank you, and committee members. My name is Dick Anderson. I'm mayor of Lincoln City, and as indicated, City Manager David Hawker is with me as well. Many of you have met previously with our city attorney, Joan Kelsey, with more specific details, so we won't go into that level. Road's End is in our urban growth boundary. There are about 920 properties and 349 acres. There are about 720 developed properties, of which 714 are served by city water. The city has served water to this area since 1978, first under a 25-year contract, not a 99-year, not a forever contract, and since on a temporary basis. It is the largest developed neighborhood in our UDB, including the city. It impacts our police, parks, community center, library, and is included in all our extensive master planning. The only access to Road's End is on city streets and impacts one of our most difficult traffic problems at the intersection of Logan Road and US 101.
I'm David Hawker. I'm the city manager. I'm the bad guy you've been hearing about. I'm also an instrument of the city council that has unanimously, in 2004, passed an ordinance that on the sale of a home, change of a name on a utility bill, that there needs to be a consent to annex and a water service agreement. The water service agreement provided that we could, as our ordinances have been in place, discontinue water at any time. The ordinance was challenged, and it went to the U.S. District Court that ruled it was valid and lawful under Oregon and U.S. law. Since that time, in 2004, we collected 250 consents and water service agreements. In 2010, we followed up with that ordinance with one that said, if we send out a notice to the property owners that haven't signed a consent that requires a consent, they would only have 60 days to do so. We have not mailed out any of those notices, but have received 170 more consents. Rhodes End is largely second homes and vacation rental dwellings. Only about 19% are locally owned. There are about 160 vacation dwellings. The city spends $1.8 million a year promoting tourism, and these vacation homes get great benefit from this promotion, yet pay nothing. In the last few years, we've invested over $9 million in projects to extend our water supply so we could serve in the UGB. That's a lot of money for a city of 7,900 people. I don't know if the city should have provided water to Rhodes End 33 years ago. We did, and now we're at the stage of having to decide how this is going to be a permanent part of our community. The process we've selected has been a methodical, slow process beginning in 2004. Under Oregon's land use system, development in the UGB sooner or later must come into the city.
The city has repeatedly offered to discuss issues of annexation with Rhodes End and will continue to do so. I believe the city is willing to consider ramping in property taxes, providing annexation can be achieved in the not-too-distant future. For 7 years, we have proceeded on a measured process under Oregon law. In both fairness and in recognition of Oregon land use system, we ask that at the 11th hour, you do not change the existing rules. Annexation of these types of urbanized areas is exactly what our land use laws contemplated. It is consistent with other state policies that do not encourage cities to provide extraterritorial services without a plan to eventually annex. Thank you, and we urge you not to move HB 3614 forward.
I just wanted to mention we will leave some documentation on.
Representative McCallum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could follow up just briefly, because I believe I neglected to put my name on the record as we began. I am Jean Cowan, and I represent House District 10, which is the district in which this question has concerned. I just want to make sure that you hear very carefully the local input and the local leadership that's working on this. Mayor Anderson was quoted in an earlier presentation, and I think it's important to see where his position is right now. He, by the way, holds the same position as did his predecessor, who served in that capacity for a number of years as well. This puts me in a very challenging position because also in the audience today are a number of the constituents in my district and constituents with whom I'm disagreeing on this particular issue. We've worked together for a long time, and it's difficult to have to come before your own constituency and say, I'm sorry, I don't support this bill. I am concerned about the provision of essential services for those individuals, water and the water necessary for sewer connections. And I am concerned that there is no existing contract for those services. There is no existing special district, as we've heard to referred to in other areas. We need to make sure that those services continue, and that's why I'm sitting before you today with this position on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Committee members, Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cowan, just to make sure that I'm hearing you right, you have a number of your constituents in here who believe that they're going to be forcibly annexed into the city, and it's your position that they should be forcibly annexed into the city?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert, I do indeed have some of my constituents here. I believe that this is an overriding issue of local control. I know that there are other individuals here from cities and perhaps counties. I've come to this body as a proponent of local control. I served as a mayor in a community and a city councilor in a community prior to moving to the coast. I served 12 years as a county commissioner. I believe in the land use planning process, and we ask of our developed communities to put in place urban growth boundaries, and then when they move forward in the logical process using those urban growth boundaries, we sit before them and tell them, no, you can't do that. That really does gut the essence of local planning. And because there is not a special district in place, I believe it's in the best interest of our greater community and my entire constituency that we allow local government to move forward with the process that they began many years ago.
Follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Hawker, I have a few questions for you. I represent a district. Part of my district has Bull Mountain in it, and they've been dealing with annexation issues for a little while. So I want to make sure that I understand a little bit about the financials around these decisions. What is the total amount of property taxes generated by the city currently?
The total it's right around $7 million. I can't tell you an exact number. I didn't bring that information.
Follow up. So how much additional property tax revenue would the city get if it annexed Rhodes End?
We would get about $900,000 in additional property tax. We would lose about $200,000 in water revenues, about $200,000 in sewer revenues, and then we would have the increased cost of service. The projection is that if we didn't ramp in taxes on an annexation, that we would come out roughly ahead about $500,000 a year.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So if you annex all these folks, you'll get the additional 911, liquor, gas, tobacco, room tax, and franchise fees.
That's all. Revenues. It's all included in the net $500,000. That's the net of everything that we would get. Loss of water revenue, loss of sewer revenue, increased property tax, state shared revenues, et cetera. The net's about maybe $600,000.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Yeah. I want to make sure that point that you just made is very, very clear. It's their water and sewer that we're talking about that is being used to forcibly annex them, but the city actually stands to lose on that particular service if you bring them in. Did I hear you correct? Even though you will make it up by taxing them on other things and by getting access to state revenues on other things. But on this issue of their water and sewer, it's actually a financial loss to the city to bring them in. Did I hear that right?
Well, it's a loss to one fund and a gain to another fund. It's a net gain to the city. Let me restate that. It's a net gain to the city of about $500,000. It could approach $600,000 if we didn't ramp in taxes, which would be one of the considerations of annexation. If taxes were ramped in over a period of time, that number would be less and then work its way up through some period of time.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Proceed.
So, again, just to be clear, these folks who are outside, you're charging more for this service right now. I've heard a figure of 212% more than what the city residents are paying. So by forcibly bringing them in, they will then pay the city rate.
That's correct.
And you will lose that revenue that you are currently getting off of them by being able to charge them a higher rate.
Yes.
Okay. One last question.
Proceed.
Thank you. I want to ask a question about the urban renewal district in your city. What is the total urban renewal division of tax loss to the city as a result of the city's decades-old urban renewal agency?
Could you please state that again? You switch gears on me so fast there that I'm having a hard time.
Yes, sir. I will ask it again. What is the total urban renewal division of tax loss to the city as a result of your urban renewal agency?
Oh, I think it's about currently about $800,000 lost to the general fund. will recapture that in 2014.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
So I've actually heard a figure of $2.4 million. Does that ring a bell at all?
Well, not to the city. That might be the total, including all the districts and all the taxing agencies.
Okay. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Garrett.
Thank you. I don't think it was made clear, at least I didn't hear it. How was water provided to these properties before 1978?
They had their own system, and apparently that system was not adequate either for the existing development or for the growth that was occurring. They came to the city requesting annexation, and we didn't have, my understanding is we didn't have the capacity at that time to provide all the city services, and instead negotiated this water service agreement that's expired.
Continue.
So they requested annexation in 1978?
Yes.
And then approximately when did the city first start contemplating annexation as part of its plan for the area?
I can't answer that. I've only been with the city for 11 years. And when that was discussed or planned for before my time, I don't know.
Somebody else know?
Representative Co-Chair?
Yes.
I guess the answer I would have is always would be the answer, because if it's in an urban growth boundary, it's always ready to be annexed. That's the reason for the land use system and the direction of growth.
Hey, Representative Holvey.
thank you, Mr. Chair. You had made a reference earlier, I think, Mr. Hawker, about a lawsuit or a court decision on the city's annexation procedures. Could you, I'm not sure I quite caught that.
Okay.
So could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. After the 2004 ordinance was passed, and we had a few property owners who would not sign the consent to annex. And rather than shut those properties off without knowing for sure we had the law solidly behind us, we filed for a declaratory judgment naming those parties. That went to state circuit court in Lincoln County, and the other side moved that up to the U.S. District Court. The U.S. District Court ruled in our favor in all regards in both the dismissed the federal claim that was in there and then chose to keep the case and decided the Oregon issues in our favor also.
Thank you. One more question?
Follow up.
Thank you. And another question about the Rhodes End area versus, I suppose, the city, the residents in the city of Lincoln City. If they were annexed, would they be paying more taxes than the other residents of Lincoln City?
Well, not more in a rate.
That was my question.
Yes.
More in a rate? Would they be paying the same rate as everybody else in Lincoln City?
If we didn't ramp in the property tax, and I know there has been, and I think should the council consider annexation, and again, all this is preliminary to get us to the point where the council could consider an annexation. This is not a foregone conclusion at any particular time. But during that consideration, or during an ordinance to annex, that will be, I'm sure, part of the discussion. So they may pay a lesser rate initially, or they may not, depending on the timing.
So just for clarity, then they would be paying, potentially, the way you're describing this ramp-up time, they would be paying less?
If there was ramp-up.
Less in property taxes than other Lincoln City residents for the same services?
If we ramped up the property tax, and I'm not saying that necessarily would occur. It's in the statute. There's a provision that can occur. It's been discussed, and that's why I don't want to dismiss that as a possibility. Ultimately, they would pay exactly the same rate as the other property owners.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Wayne Caldwell, Chris Galloway, and Mark Landauer, please. And we're going to be back on the 2 minutes. Set starting blocks. If you proceed, identify yourself and proceed.
I'm Wayne Caldwell, and I greet the chairs, Olson and Hunt, and my own representative, Garrett, from Lake Oswego. I'm a psychologist, and I've been asked to speak just because of that. I'm retired, but in October of 2009, we came against this process that caused a lot of stress. We went to close on our property in Rhodes End, and here was a form requiring us to sign to agree to annexation or we would not have water service. And we reacted to that because of a surprise. But since then, I've discovered how much stress this has caused to the residents at Rhodes End. And I just wanted to comment on stress. It's a big thing in our culture today. There's three forms of stress. Pressure, which is always external, and that's one of the things we faced with this form. There's also frustration when you have an expectation and that is not met. It meets with disappointment instead. That results in stress. And then there's conflict. Conflict comes when you are faced with a paper that says, sign this or we'll cut off your water. Or if you sign it, we'll raise your taxes. It just seemed like that was an avoidance-avoidance situation, and that produces stress. Stress affects everyone, but I think our citizens there are pretty well disappointed, and the effect of stress then is physiological. It creates obesity. It creates diabetes. It creates hypertension and heart disease. Those are the things that you generally see physiologically, but I see just a lot of disappointment around our community that I think this procedure, this new bill, will remedy. That's what we need, is a new way to approach this whole theme.
Okay. Thank you.
Representatives, co-chairs Hunt and Olson, thank you for your time, as well as the rest of the committee members. My name is Chris Jolloway, and me and my wife live in Rhodes End. House Bill 3614 is really about putting really good public policy ahead of partisan politics and special interest. It does two things for Oregonians. You know, it draws a clear line in the sand to stop the hostage annexation in exchange for essential services. Let's make it real clear. Forms signed under this duress are not consent forms. So that's very clear. Secondly, it eliminates this potential impact to homes subject to this tactic because it clears this title. Right now, there's this thing we have to sign for perpetuity that stays with the title. Okay? So this clears that as well. The bill does not do two things. It doesn't take away the right to vote for annexation. It doesn't do that, nor does it take away the consent for voluntary annexation. Prior to moving full-time to Rhodes End, I lived in Washington County, and the city of Hillsborough did a great job when we were drawn into their urban growth boundary. They came out, they talked to us, they did real talking, they listened, they drew things up, and we voluntarily, all of us went down, voluntarily signed consents. They did it right. Okay? So, there's a provision in this bill that voids consents obtained in hostage situations. It doesn't keep the cities from annexing by majority consent. It simply, like I said before, it simply clears the titles and makes those hostages whole. That's the swiftest route to justice we can have. Cities will still be able to get replacement consents. Cities can get replacement consents to annex the contracts, but the original one was truly voluntary by mutual agreement. You know, not all cities have chosen to use this extortion tactic for annexation, but those who do, as he just said, it creates an incredibly hostile, fearful, and intimidating environment. Lincoln City has chosen such a strategy, and that's just created an incredible feeling of animosity and distrust between Oregon citizens and the government that's supposed to serve us. You know, when I first opened the letter, I got this letter back in October last year.
If you could wrap it up.
When I first got this letter last year, I couldn't believe I was living in America. It really was bad. You know, in addition to the human impact, I've talked about the financial impact. We've taken this second letter and take it to a local branch manager of a national bank, and they will know that this is attached to this title. And they are very, their banks don't like this, this consent, this thing being attached to titles. So they're very leery about giving future loans or refinancing. So we need House Bill 3614 to stop this tactic, turn around this bad government, and force cities to do annexation right way. If we don't pass this legislation, you're going to have people here again and again and again, year after year, talking about this. This isn't going to go away. So we've got to have this legislation now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mark Landauer representing the Special Districts Association. Just to be clear, the Special Districts Association opposes extraterrestrial annexations. However, we do support 3614. I want to make one thing clear very early. It was mentioned previously that the city might consider phasing in the tax rate. I frankly question whether you can do it, because the Constitution says that you shall set a permanent property tax rate, and that is a permanent property tax rate. I don't think that something like that can be negotiated. But to the point of my testimony, SDO has consistently taken the position that voters should have the right to determine their governance. This position is in direct contrast, oftentimes, to cities who have made numerous attempts for years to expand the type of annexations that can occur without a vote. For example, cities will argue that they need the annexation by council resolution to be able to implement state land use laws. This argument isn't successful for three reasons. ORS 195, which was adopted about 30 years ago to address the issue of service provision. I've been before this committee before to discuss this. The law requires cities, counties, and special districts to reach agreements on who will provide key services within an urban growth boundary and urbanizing areas. Where cities have done their planning in a cooperative manner with districts and the cities under ORS 195, there have been few, if any, arguments whatsoever about service provision. Hostile annexations have almost always resulted in hostile taxpayers, hostile citizens. Forcing people into a government or zoning scheme rather than demonstrating the benefits of annexation to city or district residents results in no votes on levies and also creates a sense of not being included. Finally, SDAO has historically not opposed any annexation by a city provided it has voter approval. SDAO supports this measure because it's good policy. No landowner ought to be held hostage by a local government, and we urge this committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And finally, Jim Hoover and Linda Ludwig. Jim's still here? Go ahead, Jim. Just identify yourself and if you'd start.
Thank you. My name is Jim Hoover.
Co-chairs Hunt and Olson, thank you for the opportunity and the members to give you testimony this morning. One of the advantages of going last is that you get to hear all the testimony before you. And I happen to bring the judge's order that Mr. Hawker was referring to. It's signed April 2008 by the Honorable Thomas Coffin. And what I'm going to speak to today is what I call bullying. Mr. Coffin, in his ruling on the last page, and this is on the Lincoln City website, you're welcome to look at it, says that, moreover, property owners who choose to change the person responsible for paying the water or sewer bill can avoid discontinuation of water service by consenting to annex. Now, I'm not for or against annexation. I'm just against the process that's being used right now. And if the City of Lincoln City was following the Honorable Judge's order, their consent to annex agreement would say, by signing this consent to annex, I understand that I am now entitled to water just like the rest of the citizens of Lincoln City. But the city has a little provision in here. I'm reading from the Water Sewer Service Agreement and a consent to annex. It's all together on one document the City of Lincoln City has. And they stick this little thing in here. It says, the city retains the right to reduce the quality of water supplied by the service or entirely discontinue water service to a property outside the boundaries of the city at any time on a temporary or permanent basis by area or areas, by customer or classes of customer, in accordance with such policies the city may establish from time to time by ordinance. In a sense, what they're saying is the exact opposite of what the judge ruled in 2008, which my friend Mr. Anderson, the mayor, I guess is choosing not to acknowledge, because the judge says that you can avoid having your water shut off by signing a consent to annex, and the City of Lincoln City's water and consent to annex agreement, which occurs on the same paper, says by signing this consent to annex, I acknowledge that my water can be shut off at any time. There's a word that I've been using. It's a real hot button in the press right now. It's called bullying. Bullying isn't okay in our schools. It's not okay in our internet. It's not okay in our families. Why should it be okay in our local city government? The reason why I believe the City of Lincoln City has left that little provision in their annexation agreement is this, is I live outside of Rhodes Inn in the urban growth boundary of Lincoln City, and I'm not a privileged person that the city wants to annex. So if I sign this agreement, it may be 20 or 30 years before the city gets around to saying they want to annex me, and this will be attached to my property, running as a deed restriction because it's filed with the county for the next 20 or 30 years until the city gets around to annexing me. The other thing it does is the members of Rhodes End who have signed this are in a position where now they're pressuring their neighbors to sign it, because by them signing it, it doesn't mean they're entitled to water until everybody signs it and, in fact, they're annexed. So I can sign the consent to annex, and the lady sitting to my right can choose not to consign the consent to annex, and until she signs it and we're annexed, I'm in the same position as she is. My water can be shut off. Members of the committee, I would urge you to put this bill before the rest of the representatives for vote. I think it's imperative that we make a statement to the children of Oregon, to the residents of Oregon, that bullying isn't okay. It's not okay in schools. It's not okay on the internet. It's not okay in families, and it shouldn't be okay in city government. We can still annex. We have provisions to annex. Just forcing somebody to sign or have their water sewer shut off isn't right. Thank you very much for your consideration of this issue, and I would once again urge you to vote to pass this on to a vote of the full House of Representatives. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Linda?
Thank you. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. We've heard today that this bill is pointed towards the City of Lincoln City, but we are here representing 232 cities in the state of Oregon in opposition to the bill because it would actually impact cities on a statewide basis. A couple of notes very quickly. In terms of Representative Freeman's comments about a disclosure statement for acknowledging limited duration service agreements, or even if a property is actually inside the urban growth boundary and might be someday annexed, we believe is extremely important. We've brought that concept forward to the legislature several times. It is in contained within the annexation report that was done in 2006, and we think that would go a long way to notifying potential buyers of property of the status of their property. So having said that, I want to talk to 4 points real quickly in my written testimony. Our concerns are here. There's a retroactive provision of the bill that would void contracts that were lawfully executed in the first place by changing the criteria at a later date. And we believe it would be unduly interfere with contractual rights of parties and create a constitutional problem. An agreement to provide services is in a contractual agreement that there is a stipulation or an exchange, basically a quid pro quo for. In this instance, the quid pro quo is for services for the contract for consent to annexation. In other cities, this generally occurs at a time the consent to annex is exchanged for the services because that property is within the urban growth boundary and not within the city limits. There is no provisions within law that require a city to provide services outside the city limits and inside the urban growth boundary. But after the consent to annex is effectuated, then a property becomes eligible for annexation when it becomes contiguous to the city, because there is a contiguity requirement within statute also. Second piece, annexation of these types of urbanized areas is exactly what our land use laws contemplate. They do not contemplate or encourage city to provide extraterritorial services without a plan to eventually annex this area, and I think that's very, very important. We're concerned that if passed, this bill would slow down or prohibit or chill service provision potentially to property owners inside the urban growth boundary that want services or request it. And we believe that existing case law supports the practices of Lincoln City with regards to Rhodes End. Now, I know you heard from Mr. Orchard about case law specific to island annexation, which was significantly different than the case law body for consents to annex. And in the case of Bear Creek Valley Sanitary versus the City of Medford, the case law allows cities to require annexation consents for the provision of direct extraterritorial services, and they also ruled that consents are a lawful alternative to the popular vote. And this has been for the last couple of decades, this case law has been on the books. Also, the United States District Court, Federal Court, City of Lincoln City versus Rhodes End Sanitary District, the court specifically brought forward the concerns that the defendants brought forward about the continuation of services being eligible for annexation consents. And the court said, and it's on the back of my testimony here, but briefly, based on the foregoing, this is a very strong determination. The fact that the water system and the water service are already in existence does not make the city's annexation program invalid. There is no legal impediment to the city's action under Oregon statutes, law, or constitution, nor is there a legal impediment to the city's action under the constitution, laws, and statutes of the United States. The City of Lincoln City's program to annex the Rhodes End area is lawful and valid. This court looked not only within the case law body for the state of Oregon, but across the nation, and did not find any concerns or any case law that would oppose the practice that Lincoln City is doing currently by requiring or making available consent to annex for the continuation of service. In fact, there was a case...
If you could wrap it up, I appreciate it. Thank you.
In Ohio, that they did articulate that says that practice is lawful. So again, our concerns that this bill, as written, would have statewide impacts. There are many cities in the state that do rely on annexation consents for a variety of other types of situations, and we would be very concerned if the bill were to pass it in its form currently.
Any questions, Representative Winger, if you could quickly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda, I heard you say that you believe annexation of urban areas is what our land use laws contemplate. Who required Lincoln City to bring this to territory into the UGB?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Wingard, cities and counties were required after the passage of our land use program bill in mid-70s to develop urban growth boundaries. and those grant boundaries would contain a 20-year supply of available land for residential and commercial industrial purposes. So at that point in time, I'm assuming that, as most cities did, they drew up through a public process and set their urban growth boundaries, as well as the counties, and adopted that into the comprehensive plan that went probably in the mid to late 70s to DLCD for acknowledgement.
Follow up.
Do you know of any other city in Oregon that is doing what Lincoln City is doing?
I know of many other cities that require consents for annexation in exchange for services outside city limits and inside the UGB. This fact set, where a district had initially provided services that were taken over, where there was a health hazard problem and were taken over by the city some time ago, may be replicated in other places. I cannot testify to that today.
Final question. If you could wrap it up with this one. Thank you.
Does the League oppose the portion of this bill that would be prospective and that would prohibit this kind of forced hostage annexation from happening in the future?
We believe the law is firm that would allow cities to have the ability to continue to provide services to request consents for annexation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this? Okay, thank you. I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3114 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3621.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3621. This is for a person who received a ballot measure 37 waiver. This is ballot measure 37 from 2005. It allows that person to use the property as provided by the waiver if the person expended more than $400,000 in that use.
Okay, Representative Gilliam and Leroy Lack. Representative Gilliam, if you'd go ahead and proceed, we're short on time, so you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Vic Gilliam from District 18, Silverton, Molalla. I'm happy to, on behalf of my constituent here to my right, Leroy, and other Oregonians, bring this bill forward, because I think what, in my effort, anyway, is to try to provide some certainty and fairness into Measure 37. The ruling by courts are really the thing that prevents my constituent and others from what I believe are their property rights. But as we all know, we are the policy arm of this great state of Oregon, and you today in the Rules Committee are that policy committee. So I hope you will listen to this to my constituent and others and listen to the very simple idea that if you are playing by the rules, even though the rules in Oregon shift and change, but if you give a sincere effort and you spend, we picked this number for a reason, if you spend over $400,000, shouldn't you be allowed to proceed if you began on legal, square, fair footing? So I hope you'll listen to the bill, and I know you're running short on time, and I would urge you to listen to the proponents and then maybe not so many of the opponents.
Okay, thank you. Where we're at it. Dave, you want to come on up and sit with them, too, as well, for to complete this panel out? Okay. Shalak?
Yes. Honorable Representative, co-chairs, representatives, I'm very inexperienced at this, so if you'll forgive me if I make any errors, I appreciate that. And also, I am in my mid-80s, and I'm going to do the best job I can to make my presentation. Back in 1970...
If you'd identify yourself, for the record.
Excuse me. Thank you. I said I was inexperienced. My name is Leroy Locke. Do you need my address or anything?
No, thank you.
Okay. In 1971, a group of four purchased 210-plus acres located in the 9800 block of Liberty Road South in Salem, Oregon. The property was zoned RA, which allowed for residential development. It was acquired from Francis Holt, who had Moline and Heiss do all the requirements to subdivide into 5-acre lots with gravel streets. A preliminary approval was granted subject to reducing the lot sizes to 1 acre and paving the streets. After meeting with Randy Curtis, who was the planning director for Marion County, and with assurance they could assume Mr. Holt's position with no time limitation, they purchased the property. They never had any interest or intent to farm. The property had a history of foreclosures and bankruptcies. In 1969 was the last year it was farmer-owned, farmer-owner-operated, and it was in the final days of redemption after being foreclosed on when it sold. The ownership was purchased by Mr. Holt in 1971. He obtained the right, as I think I addressed earlier, to develop it and decided to sell. The four people acquired the property and were stopped in their plans to develop it when it was downzoned from RA to SA to EFU. That was in the late 70s. We worked very hard at trying to regain the rights that we acquired with the property. Measure 37 was passed and looked like it offered promise, but it was overruled by Judge Lipscomb. Subsequently, 37 was passed, and in December of 2004, I applied for the right to subdivide the property. We completed all the engineering and the necessary work for that to happen. It was approved by the state of Oregon, approved by Marion County, and we went ahead and proceeded to have all of the engineering, the septic approvals, 3 wells drilled, and started on putting in a road when we were stopped because the contractor developer, had not acquired the right permits that he was told he should obtain were incorrect, so he had to reapply, and he finally got the right permits, started again, and we proceeded to work until we were shut down by Measure 49. At that time, we had spent over $500,000 in engineering, septic approvals, wells, roads, and so forth. Today it's still the two nice hills out there in South Salem, growing weeds and grass. It has not been farmed profitably, and no one, I've sent letters, made calls to farmers, offered it to them free, farm it free, just farm it, and have been denied by all because it was not quality farmland. In 1999, I obtained a letter from a soil scientist named Robert Bob McDowell, who stated the soil was not productive agricultural soil. The two best uses for the property are actually, due to the terrain and so forth, residential or open space. We have been physically, I'd like to have that psychologist or whatever speak for me, because we have been physically and mentally frustrated pursuing this thing for the last 40 years, approximately 35, I think 34 years actually, and run into one roadblock after another roadblock. When we, in good faith, started to develop it under 37, we felt we were okay. The passage of 49 denied us that right. We think it's unfair, once you've invested a lot of your money into a project, to have the rules of the game changed. I also want to say that Oregon's economy, being what Oregon's economy is, the need for employment and taxes is pretty great, and this would offer both. It offers employment, and it would offer tax revenues. I wish to thank you people for listening to me. Like I said, I'm not as good at this as I should be, so I apologize.
You did well. Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, in support of this bill. Measure 49, which passed in 2007, authorizes a Measure 37 claimant who has what's known as a vested right to continue forward with that Measure 37 development, complete it, and then it has the status of a non-conforming use. The trouble with Measure 49 is that when the legislature ran that bill out in 2007, they specified that the vested rights determination will be made by the courts under existing law that was set out by the courts in the early 70s in the Holmes case. And so there are a variety of factors that the courts use in determining whether or not a property owner has a vested right. One of those factors is how much money they've spent in relationship to the total project costs of the development. So if you have a $10 million development, you have to spend, and the figure that the court uses, the Supreme Court used in the Holmes case was 7%. So on a $10 million development, if you had spent $700,000, that was one of the criteria that the court would consider in determining whether or not you should be allowed then to continue forward and complete the project. Those principles, as Representative Gilliam was indicating earlier, those principles are equitable and they're set out by the court. In essence, for purposes of vested rights and for purposes of Measure 49, it's the court, the Oregon Supreme Court, that set the policy in this area rather than the legislature. What this bill does is it has what we believe and what the Constitution sets forth. It lets the policy-making branch of this government actually set the policy rather than having the Oregon Supreme Court do that. And it does so by saying, look, if you've spent $400,000, that's a good faith sign that you're actually, you know, it's $400,000 in response to a valid Measure 37 claim. So it's not that you just go out and start spending money and to develop your property. You have a valid Measure 37 claim. You've got it approved by the state. You've got it approved by the county. You then at that point go out and spend $400,000 or more to do the development work that's been authorized pursuant to your Measure 37 claim. At that point, that under this bill and something that we support, that should be enough. That's a good faith showing that you're serious about the development and that it would be unfair at that point essentially to have a new ballot measure come along and pull the rug out from under your feet. So that's what this bill does. We think it's a good bill, common sense bill, and we very much support it.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Winger.
Do you have any idea how many people this bill would affect and allow who put in over $400,000 into a development and are currently not capable of recouping that in any way, shape, or form?
Co-Chairs Olson and Hunt, Representative Wingard, I don't know the answer to that. There haven't. It's a high bar, obviously. I'm not aware. And I've talked to quite a number of vested rights claimants under 49. I'm not aware of well, there's one besides Mr. Lack that I know that's spent that kind of money.
Okay.
I don't think it's significant. I don't think the number is significant.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Chair Hunt.
David, your last point. You talked about the courts apply the 7% standard, and this bill would apply a dollar standard. I mean, it seems like $400,000 on a really small, cheap piece of property, $400,000, it seems like might be too high of a requirement. But on something that's, you know, some massive land claim, $400,000 might be too low. Can you just talk a little bit more about why the dollar amount instead of maybe a different percentage than 7%, but why the dollar amount instead of a percentage?
Co-Chair Hunt, I think that, and this is a question maybe for Representative Gilliam, but I think the purpose behind the dollar amount is just to make sure that the people that would be able to take advantage of this bill had demonstrated a significant financial investment in order to continue forth. If you change the percentage, which you certainly could do, these are equitable, this is an equitable number picked essentially out of the air by the Oregon Supreme Court. So you could change it. If you change that percentage downward from 7% on a small project, you'd probably, I think the impact is in terms of development rights under 49 would be significantly higher than it is by picking this number.
Okay, good point, thanks. Representative Barnhart, if you could quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really for the property owner. I would be very interested in having a timeline of the dates when you applied for and received your permits and the dates when funds were expended. That would be helpful. And I don't need it today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger, Kate, Tim, is it Gus? Thank you, Gus. Oski and Gloria Bennett, please.
Good afternoon.
And we're going to just 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
Yep.
Good afternoon, representatives of the committee, co-chairs Olson and Hunt, and other members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president of Friends of Marion County. We are an affiliate of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And in 2007, oh, by the way, I did submit this testimony in writing to the committee beforehand, so if you had an opportunity to review it before my comments, that would be great. You'll sort of get a background of what I'm talking about. But in 2007, 62% of Oregon voters approved Measure 49, and this was a legislative remedy to a badly drafted Measure 37. Firstly, Measure 49 provided several paths for Measure 37 claimants to pursue. They could get 3 to 10 home sites under express and conditional options, and they could also seek a vested right to continue with their development if enough work had been done prior to the effective date of Measure 49. Here in Marion County, a Measure 37 subdivision on groundwater-limited land threatened neighboring wells. Measure 49 required that a vested right be granted under common law. Ignoring the common law by setting a dollar limit on groundwater protection is not reasonable. How much is your property worth if the development next door depletes your water supply? Secondly, HB 3621 ignores the hard work by all sides to achieve a compromise satisfactory to the voters. By setting an expenditure threshold on Measure 49 development, HB 3621 ignores legal precedents by the Oregon Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, which have found that a ratio of actual expenditures to the total cost of development is a key vesting factor. The arbitrary $400,000 amount established in HB 3621 sets a threshold without legal merit, as it treats large 37 claims much differently from smaller claims. Finally, developers whose expenditures exceeded $400,000 are most likely corporations or LLCs and have long ago expensed those costs in their business taxes. The beneficiaries were their lawyers and accountants. The real losers are the neighbors who spent vast sums to protect their groundwater and preserve farm and forest lands in Oregon. So I urge you to please vote no and do not pass this out of your committee. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Whichever of you would like to go. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tim Jaskowski. I'm a property owner and member of a large South Salem neighborhood group called the Keep Our Water Safe Committee. Collectively, we have spent over $30,000 to bring reason and fact to a Measure 37 claim affecting high-value farmland in a groundwater-limited area in our neighborhood, a claim that would negatively impact our water supply and thereby property values and livability. As a result of our work, an independent expert concluded that there was inadequate groundwater available for the subdivision as well as the existing users, and surface water rights would also likely be infringed on. Additionally, after Measure 49, a county judge reviewed the evidence and concluded that the claimant had not adequately established the proposed use on the ground, so he was not vested. Therefore, this bill should be seen as nothing other than an attempt to circumvent all prior and adequate legal proceedings. It allows an arbitrary dollar amount, one that replaces the equitable test that currently apply to all property owners, and applies that arbitrary sum to the vesting of a small handful of claimants. It is overly simplistic. If it is passed, it would complicate and confuse matters and lead to further unnecessary litigation. We have common law that provides a fair and equitable solution. We already have a law that provides a procedure to fairly determine who is vested or who is not vested. And we have Measure 49, soundly supported by Oregonians, to rein in abuses of Measure 37. I worked tirelessly with my neighbors to protect our properties. We relied on Oregon's judges to decide based on reason and fact. If this bill is passed, it would make a mockery of the justice we receive through the legal system. It would undo Measure 49, what it did for a small handful of large residential commercial developments. This bill is nothing other than an attempt to circumvent legal proceedings. It's not only simplistic and unfair, but it also is completely unnecessary. And for these reasons, I urge you to kill this bill.
Proceed.
Thank you. My name's Gloria English Bennett. I live on acreage in the Rickrail area. Moved there about 30 years ago and was happy to be in the country and had children with 4-H projects and all of those many things that go with owning a small acreage. Measure 37 changed that. Or attempted to change that by a neighbor proposing and beginning to set up the groundwork for a large commercial development and houses on a large acreage that surrounds our smaller acreages. And we were very disturbed, have fought that up until now, and we have still have a case pending against that landowner. We feel that this, as you said, the simple solution of setting an amount and letting that be the measure of whether you can or can't go forward or have not been able to go forward is simply doesn't make any sense. For those of us who have been fighting some of these cases for a long time, it absolutely does not make sense. And again, being a farm girl at heart and having born in eastern Kansas, it just breaks my heart to see the farmland that is being paved over, and we have some of the most beautiful dirt out there on the rickrail floor. So I really urge you to think carefully about land use issues, and I do not support this kind of solution. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee members, for those of you who can stay, we'll try to have this done by 5:15, if you could stay that long. We still have one other bill to listen to here, and I'd like to wrap this one up if we can quickly. Lane Setterly, Ralph, is it Blommer?
Bloomer.
And then Courtney Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll go ahead and get started while they're coming
up. That would be outstanding, and if you could do it quickly.
Sure, I will. For the record, Lane Shetterly. I'm appearing here today as private citizen, carrying absolutely no portfolio but my own, although having an interest in the bill, having been director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development and participated in the drafting of ballot measure 49 during the 2007 session. A couple of things I just want to touch on very briefly. This bill actually makes a very major change to Measure 49. It's not a tweak. The concept of vested rights, common law vested rights, was a central element in Measure 49. Mr. Bloomers and I just were at the Supreme Court today on a vested rights case. I brought my brief with me in the explanatory statement for the measure. It told the voters that claimants who have received land use waivers under Measure 37 are entitled to complete developments under the provisions of Measure 37 if they have established vested rights to do so. Representative McPherson on the floor in the House explained Measure 49 by saying that for those owners who want to proceed under the original language of Measure 37, they can establish that they have vested rights under standard common law principles that determine whether a person has vested rights and proceed under the original language of the measure. So it's very explicit that the measure incorporated this concept of vested rights for those claimants who want to proceed with their ballot Measure 37 claim. Vested rights includes a host of factors, seven of them in total that are well established in common law. Those factors include the expenditure ratio, how much have you spent compared to the total value of the expense of the project, good faith, notice, adaptability, use, location, and cost, and then what they call mere preparation. There's a well-developed body of case law that addresses this whole concept of when a right is vested. And your earlier conversation here about, well, should it be, is $400,000 the right number, or should it be less than 7%, is precisely why we who were involved in the drafting of the measure reverted back to the common law standard, because there is no one right measure for all cases. What about the person who spent $390,000? Why should they feel okay about this bill? You just told them that their $390,000 wasn't enough. But maybe it was, depending on the total value of the project. My point is that, and also 7%, Dave Honeycutt said that the Holmes case said it's a 7% standard. Actually, 7% was the Holmes case, but there is no hard and fast standard percentage. The courts apply it all based on all of these factors. And I think it's not only a major change in Measure 49 that the voters approved by a majority that was greater than what they approved Measure 37, but also gets you into this business of picking and choosing winners that we intentionally and clearly avoided in drafting the measure just by reverting to common law, saying there's a well-developed body of law that can establish what is a vested use. Let's use that. That was presented clearly to the legislature when they approved the measure. It was presented clearly to the voters when they approved the measure, and I would urge you not to depart.
Okay, thank you.
So,
if you could do it very quickly.
Yes. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Ralph Bloomers. I have provided testimony on behalf of a number of clients that I represent. I did appear in the Supreme Court today, and everything that Mr. Shetterly just said is exactly right. I just want to respond to the question, how many claimants will it affect? Because that's something that will affect a number of claimants, maybe up to a dozen, and they're exactly the kind of developments that Measure 49 sought to prevent. They're large commercial or residential developments that there was only a gravel road at most on the ground. In many cases, there was nothing done on the ground, and it will vest them and allow them to complete that. Mrs. Bennett testified there's a gravel road that was thrown down in November, but they are looking to develop 137 acres in residential commercial development on farmland. This bill would potentially authorize that to go forward, even though that's exactly what 49 was intended to prevent. The common law comes from the Constitution. This isn't judge-made policy, as Mr. Honeycutt said. That's a false frame. This comes from the U.S. Constitution. It protects private property rights, and it's about fairness. But it's not just fairness to Mr. Lack or fairness to one claimant. It's fairness to all property owners. And Judge Nellie Johnson looked at Mr. Lack's claim, and, you know, when he represents to you that he spent $400,000, the actual reality is that four other people were involved and other people spent money, but a number of those dollars were spent without permits and were spent, and the judge found, were spent in bad faith without proper permits. So even the representations that you're getting here today are part of the picture, and this is exactly why the court should be looking at this, not you guys monkeying around in the common law vested rights test. This was created by judges people mandate to protect property. It's working fine as it is, and the courts are sorting through it. It's not easy, but it's a question of fairness. And by rigging it in favor of this arbitrary $400,000, you're going to be doing a disservice to all property owners in Oregon, and you're, as Mr. Shetterly said, overriding the will of the voters in 49. So I would urge you to not pass this out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Courtney Johnson. I'm here today on behalf of individual property owners in Clatsop County, members of the Shamrock Pines Homeowners Association, and members and property owners of Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. I would just echo the comments of those who have spoken before me in opposition of this bill and just point out that the questions that you have raised are exactly those that the common law test is designed to address. $400,000 may be a lot for a small property project, but it may not be a lot for a large project. What was the timeline of the expenditures? When did you have notice? When were your expenditures made? Those are exactly the types of questions that are addressed by the common law test that was adopted by the voters of the state, and I would just urge you on behalf of those residents in Clatsop County to not move this bill forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to close the...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Representative Berger.
It's 5 after 5. I've had a very long day, and yes. I would like it for the record that I have not been monkeying around, Mr. Blomers.
And I have one quick one.
If you'd come back, sit down, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
You made several assertions about the case. Were you involved in the case?
Yes.
Thank you.
I represented the neighbors whose well water would be threatened by a large sinking of 40 wells across the street.
Thank you. That answers my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winger.
Question. I just have a statement.
Okay, proceed.
I have a motto I like to share, that democracy must be more than two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for dinner. And in my time around the legislature, nothing is more unseemly than when we argue about what to do with somebody else's private property rights. And there's a reason why they are protected and why they are supposed to be outside of the process of people voting on how to divvy up somebody else's property. And these conversations are always very sad to me.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3621 for right now, and I'm going to return back to it. But right now, I have some folks that are waiting and have been waiting all the time, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3635.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3635 clarifies that employees of canneries, dryers, and packing plants on farms where the farm is the single largest supplier of products processed are not eligible for overtime wages.
Welcome to the House Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, state rep out of the Albany area, and this will be very quick. I have with me Dennis Purcell, attorney from the Eugene area, but this was brought to my attention in regards to an issue involving Stallbush Island Farms, which is located off Peoria Road in Linn County near, it's right on the edge of the Willamette River in Benton County. But it deals with a wage issue and trying to change a law that would bring some equity to what's happening in the base of having a cannery located on the property that is owned by the farm, that is operated by the farm, and then produce that is also produced on the farm and then brought there. And there's some just confusion, and it's incongruent from some of the Department of Agriculture rules that have been created over the last couple of years with that of what the federal guidelines are, as well as Bureau of Oregon Labor and Industry as well. And that's what this bill does, is to try to bring a little bit of clarity.
Welcome. Dennis Purcell. I'm an attorney in Eugene. Thank you for your time. To highlight the problem that farmers are facing, I'm going to read to you two portions of sections, one from the Oregon Farmers Handbook and the other from a Boley website. The Oregon Farmers Handbook says, with respect to overtime, that Oregon processing workers are entitled to time and a half pay over 10 hours a day unless the processing plant is located on a farm and is primarily processing products produced on that farm. So the idea is you don't pay overtime to workers who are working in your processing plant that's on the farm. Now turn to Boley's FAQs in their technical assistance program or technical assistance area regarding agriculture, and they tell you that, for example, workers who pack fruit grown by a neighboring farmer must be paid overtime if they work more than 40 hours in the same work week. Farmers are confused by these. They tend to look to the handbook, which has been their Bible of Oregon law, and they've been confused by Boley's position. They've been confused by attorneys who have sued them looking for overtime wages for folks. This bill simply clarifies and provides some certainty to those farmers, and it basically says if you've got a processing plant on your farm and you are the single largest provider of produce to that processing plant, you're not going to be obligated to pay overtime to your employees. It's going to be a benefit to those farmers, not only that have the processing plant, but it's also a benefit to those farmers who don't have a processing plant but who would like to provide or send their produce to that plant for processing, because it's going to keep the cost down. Questions?
Any questions for this panel? Representative Holby.
Thank you. I'm sort of curious as to the, if you could tell me historically why these workers as opposed to other workers wouldn't be entitled to overtime.
Historically, agricultural workers have been exempt from overtime. In fact, it's one of the additional confusing parts. When you look at the definition of agriculture that's provided in the BOLI regulations, it says agriculture includes farming in all of its branches and, among other things, includes cultivation, tillage, all the things you would expect, and includes preparation for market delivery or to storage or to market or to carriers transportation to market of those goods that you produce. And those folks have always been exempt from overtime. So we've got this conflict in BOLI's FAQs and the position that BOLI takes with respect to overtime versus what, for example, the Farmer's Handbook has said to farmers for years. We've researched this back to, I believe, the 70s, that farmers have been told that they're exempt from overtime for this kind of work. And I've got a farmer that got very surprised, and it was a very expensive surprise. Let me tell you one of the primary fallouts from this. Oregon has a provision in the Wage and Hour Act that says if you haven't paid all of your wages and overtime at the time the person leaves, you're subject not only to pay that person's that amount, but you're also subject to a 30-day wage penalty. The net effect of that is we've got workers who had a overtime amount of maybe $50, but under Oregon's penalty law, they'd have a right to collect somewhere in the area of $1,500 for their 30 days' wages. So a $50 problem turns into to a $1,550 problem, all in the context of a bill that is without clarity, and in fact, I think, makes the Oregon Farmer's Handbook true when it may not have been true when first written.
Thank you very much for coming to the Rules Committee. We have three additional witnesses on this bill, Steve, Larry, and Sybil. Appreciate you staying this late, and would ask you to keep your comments brief, please.
For the record, I'm Larry Kleinman. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of PECUN, P-C-U-N, Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, Oregon's Farm Worker Reforestation Worker Union, saving the best for last here on a Monday afternoon. Briefly, I just want to say that we oppose this bill. We oppose this bill for four reasons. First of all, in principle, we're against these kinds of carve-outs. In fact, we are against the carve-out that's in the statute as presently written. We haven't brought legislation to pursue that, but in principle, we think that's a bad idea. Workers ought to get overtime, period. We think it's a bad idea to carve out workers on minimum wage, on rest breaks. Those have now been granted by regulation. So that's the first point. Second point is I don't think there's any good or compelling reason that's been offered about why to discriminate based on the origin of products. We oppose discrimination generally, but here we're being asked to discriminate in the application of overtime according to where these products have come from. And this expands, well, I don't know if it's asserted that this is the case, but this clearly expands the exemption. It doesn't simply clarify it. The word primary source means that as long as the source of these products is more than anybody else's source, if you have a grower who has 30% products packed in that shed and everybody else is less, because it's eight different other growers, that
then exempts that packing shed from overtime. Current law, I believe, says 50% or more, or so it would be interpreted. That's the second objection. The third one is many growers that we've dealt with also are owners of processors, processors that are not on their property. And NORPAC is the leading example of that in our state. NORPAC is a cooperative, 11th largest food processor in the country, largest one west of the Mississippi, owned by 240 growers. At NORPAC, overtime laws apply as according to statute. And so the question is, and obviously other products are brought from other than those growers' farms, but if those growers who own the cannery find it to be acceptable or at least obey the law and don't seem to have economic distress of paying overtime in the cannery, then but in their own cannery on their own farm, that's should be dealt with otherwise. Lastly, we believe the remedy, if growers are oppressed by overtime, is hire more workers. We hear a lot about the need for jobs. We hear a lot about Oregon having a high unemployment rate. Here's an opportunity to say, share the hours, pay people 40 hours. If you don't want to pay overtime, hire more workers, create more jobs. And I just want to say lastly that while we always hear horror stories from folks about $50 mistakes that turn into $1,500 penalties, I challenge somebody to come forward with a case in which somebody who was advised of a $50 wage violation and complaint brought to Boley, that Boley actually imposed a $1,500 penalty. Boley, I think, has bent over backwards to for employers who are cooperative, unless it's a repeat offense, unless some other circumstances are involved. If it's simply a mistake of $50, I challenge anyone to come forward with a $1,500 penalty case or even something approaching that. Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today. I am here to express some concerns about the bill as it's drafted. I've spoken with a few members of the committee and with the sponsors, and I appreciate the attention paid to the issue. From the Law Center's perspective, as you know, we provide services to low-income Oregonians, many of whom are working in jobs that are hard work, long hours, and not as much pay as we might like. They're good, decent jobs. We're concerned about overtime because it does play a big factor in the amount of dollars that people receive to take home to their families and meet their daily needs. So it's an important issue for us. And the concern that I have with respect to this bill, and I should add a caveat that my expertise is in family law and domestic violence. I am not an employment attorney, so I've gotten feedback from our attorneys, and what I'm here to express is that the way this bill is drafted, if I'm reading it correctly and based on the testimony of the attorney who spoke before me, is that there would be a significant expansion to the exemption under this bill as it's drafted, because right now, based on the concept that agricultural workers are exempt from overtime, and the bill, the current law provides that exemption when the packing is done primarily for crops and produce that comes from the farm on which the packing plant exists. And I think that's sort of, in my layman's sort of brain, this is a farm. This is not a processing plant. This business is a farm, and they happen to be processing a lot of stuff, but the primary stuff that they're processing is the stuff that they're growing. This would change that significantly such that the packing plant could be processing 3% of its overall produce could be from the farm that it's situated on, and 97% could be from elsewhere that it's getting imported in, as long as each single person supplying the other produce was less than 3%. And that just seems like a significant shift in the concept of what the current law is drafted to allow. And so we do have a concern about the impact on low-income workers if this bill were to move forward. I think if there is confusion about what the current law is, there would be other ways for us to clarify that by redrafting manuals or taking a look at that. But we think the bill would be an expansion, and so we're concerned about it. Thanks.
Thank you. Steve?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we oppose House Bill 3635 as it's currently written. In our opinion, it goes beyond clarification of the existing overtime exemption, and it really broadens it. And so the bottom line for us is that more workers would be excluded from overtime pay. Thanks.
Okay. Committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify on this bill? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3635. Committee members, before going further, the HCRs that you have, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, and 34, are going to be moved to next Monday, May 9th. And for those of you who wish, have to leave.
Can we do this one? Can we do this legislative introduction?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chair.
I'm going to open a work session on this.
Going to open up a work session on...
Just committee bill introductions.
Committee bill introduction.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is LC 4160. It's been distributed to the members. It would be a concurrent resolution honoring Denny Jones.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 4160, dated 4/29/11, be introduced as a committee measure.
Chair Hunt moves that LC 4160, dated 4/29/11, as a committee bill. Is there any objection? So moved. Close.
Thank you.
And we're going to open a public hearing back.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we should point out that for people who might be listening, this is a concurrent resolution that would honor Denny Jones on the occasion of his 100th birthday.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, in lieu of that, I don't feel it's necessary to put on the record what I normally do, which is that supporting introduction of a bill is not necessary, does not show necessary objection or support of any idea. But in this case, okay, Denny Jones is 100.
Oh, well.
That's the end of those plans. Where's the fast disclaimer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you very much. Also, for those members who need to be excused, proceed. We're going to go ahead and finish up the committee hearing on House Bill 3631 or 21. So feel free to leave if you need to. I'm going to reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3621. And Rich Heresy? Okay. Dwayne? And then Michael?
Come at the same time?
Yes. And Pat Wheeler. Okay. If you identify yourself and get
Chairman Olson and members of the committee, my name is Richard Harrisay. I come from the Sublimity area, and I'm representing the Marion County Democratic Central Committee's Legislative Committee today. I'm here. We're asking you that you do not move this bill out of committee. That's 3621. We're back on. Okay. The Marion County Democratic Central Committee worked hard to help pass Measure 49 in 2007. Measure 49 passed handily, statewide, 62-38%. Even in the conservative Marion County, the measure passed 66-33. We see HB 3621 as an attempt to circumvent the will of the voters. It's just that simple. I believe that you will hear today, perhaps not, testimony about a case in Marion County in which a measure 37/49 applicant, after the passage of Measure 49 and without a permit, cut trees, plowed roads so that he and his partners could say they were vested, impacted neighbors, had to spend thousands and thousands of dollars fighting the builders in court. The impacted neighbors prevailed. Please don't allow the court cases to be deemed null and void by allowing this bill to become law. Thank you for your time and concern. And on a personal note, not as a representative of the committee, I would ask you to move forward with HJM 9. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Okay. Sir, if you'd identify yourself then.
Yes, I'm M. Dwayne Rollins, one of the partners that this bill would affect. And there's been a lot of discussion, and you have a lot of documentation from various people, but this went through a lot of hearings, always being approved, and it's been appealed and appealed and appealed, and we have had to respond to the appeals, and then it's not like water or some of these other issues were not discussed by hearings officer, by the county commissioners, who approved it, and then it gets to a judge. And I was there, and she said, "I'm sorry, I don't know very much about this. You'll have to educate me." So after education, she disapproved. And so it's kind of something more than just whether we were invested, because everybody said we were invested until a judge whose primary expertise is not in that area said, no, you're not invested. And so that amount of money might not mean much to you, but that's a significant part of my own personal holdings, and it was just set aside. And so I don't think this is going to change the world, but it would certainly assist those who do pay substantial amounts of their own. And we're not a big corporation or none of that. That's a bit of misrepresentation. We're four individuals, three of us in our 80s, and the other partner died, and so his son took over. So it's not like we're big, huge developers. That's it. Thank you. And I was outside. I was listening to your cases, and I know it's difficult to try to find wisdom and the right thing to do, but I appreciate your just being willing to hear us. So thank you very much. It's part of our democratic process. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes, gentlemen, for the record, I can assure you that we do consider that a significant amount of money.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. So, thank you very much. Anyone else here that's left? Yes.
Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy. I am representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I just wanted to try to correct one misperception about the number of claimants that this would affect. I have submitted written testimony, so I'm not going to go over all that again. However, the way that the bill is written, a claimant has to expend $400,000 to complete or continue the use. It does not say when that amount has to be expended by. So this would have the effect of not only resurrecting the claims from before, where the money was spent before December 6, 2007, but could also be used to retroactively. Somebody could spend money today, for example, spend $400,000 today to resurrect their Measure 37 claim. And we feel like that really goes against the will of the voters in Measure 49. Thank you.
Representative Wingert.
So assume that this was a mistake in the drafting of the bill,
mm-hmm.
and the intention was by the drafter of the bill to allow people who had invested $400,000 or more before Measure 49 passed and was implemented. Does your organization have some calculation as to how many property owners that would affect?
Chair Olson, Representative Wingert, no, we do not know how many that would be.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We close the work session, public hearing on House Bill 3621, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
And we're carrying over.